This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Rising rent and a growing population has combined to leave many Central Floridians scrambling to find housing that meets their budgets. The Sadowski Fund, set aside for affordable housing, is typically used for other things, but Governor Ron DeSantis is proposing to leave it alone this year, and affordable housing advocates are urging lawmakers to follow the governor's lead. Meanwhile, some Orlando lawmakers have introduced a bill to give cities and counties more power to impose rent control. So what's the solution to the affordable housing crisis? How much are local governments putting into building more affordable housing? And how do wages and mass transit fit into the picture? We're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252 and your comments and questions on Twitter on affordable housing. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining me in the studio, Sarah Albadri. She is Special Projects Manager with Westlakes Partnership. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
We're also joined by Amanda Gill. She's the Government Affairs Director with the Florida Apartment Association. Thank you so much for joining us, Amanda.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Shannon Nasworth is the President and CEO of Ability Housing. Shannon, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Well, Sarah, I want to start with you. You work closely with the Westlakes community in Orlando. A lot of residents struggle economically. What kinds of concerns do they have, and how does that factor into housing and making sure they have, you know, a place to live that is stable?
Yeah, so Westlakes is a really interesting community in the city of Orlando in that home ownership is actually really high in that community. But in terms of new opportunities for newer residents, it's much more difficult to find. Rents have increased all over the city, all over the county and the region. But wages have been pretty stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
Home ownership rates have declined overall. But here in Westlakes, it's pretty strong. But at the same time, it's just like huge demand for affordable rental units.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just that it's finding opportunities. We have in Westlakes a really incredible apartment development that happened, which is Pendana. We had thousands of people apply for 200 units, right?
And this is affordable housing specifically?
Yeah, it's a mixed income community. It's really great, high quality. It's the kind of place anyone would want to live. And obviously, a lot of people wanted to live there.
Mm-hmm.
The demand is so high and the supply is so low.
And so did the Westlakes Community Partnership, did this organization come about because you really wanted to address housing issues? Is that the sort of main goal of the partnership you're part of?
Yeah, so the partnership is a growth of really amazing community organizing that happened with the residents. They really wanted to have a voice at the table regarding redevelopment and revitalization of their community, and wanted to have a really direct seat at the table. Lift Orlando is an incredible community partner and had a vision for Westlakes, but wanted to do it alongside residents and has done a great job of helping us create this nonprofit organization and a true partnership with residents, business leaders, and the reinvestment that's coming into the community.
And for our listeners who might not be familiar with it, what is Lift Orlando?
Yeah, so Lift Orlando is also a nonprofit organization focused on the Westlakes footprint, which is mm-hmm. really from Colonial to Gore or Orange Center Boulevard, OBT to John Young, and really just focusing on the revitalization of that community, from housing to education to health and wellness, a really holistic overview of how you do community redevelopment well.
Is there still, though, a threshold that even projects like the one you're talking about, the Pendana development and even what Lift Orlando is doing, I mean, are there some folks who are saying, I still can't afford to get into these places?
Yeah, because I think simply because the supply isn't there, right? Mm-hmm. It's that we've had so many people apply, and Pendana is a true mixed income community, very low income to moderate income to market rate housing. But with 200 units and thousands of people applying, of course, you can't all get in. And so it's just really thinking about, as a region, how do we build more affordable housing?
Mm-hmm. We were talking affordable housing on Intersection. We're with Sarah Albadri, Amanda Gill, and Shannon Nasworth. We want to hear from you, too. Are you one of those folks who are seeing some of these developments go in, are sort of knocking on the door and saying, I want in on this, and maybe one of the folks who have been lucky to get into one of these apartments or maybe not so lucky, still looking around? 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. You can also reach out to us on Twitter with your questions and comments. We are at WMFE Orlando. Talking affordable housing, that number again, 1-866-338-5252. Shannon Nasworth, We've talked to you before about on this program about what Ability Housing does, and Ability Housing has some projects in Jacksonville and also in Orlando upcoming. Just explain a little bit about what you're doing with the City of Orlando and how that is kind of helping to alleviate at least some of the demand for affordable housing.
Absolutely. So Ability Housing is a nonprofit affordable housing developer like Lyft and the Westlakes community. We're really focusing on trying to provide housing that enriches our residents' lives. Right now we have two properties that are under construction. One is a rehab in Eatonville, and when we're done, it'll be 77 affordable apartments. And then we have a new construction project on Mercy Drive that has been a wonderful partnership with the City of Orlando. I'm sure the community is aware that they purchased a portfolio of distressed properties, and in partnership, they funded the demolition of that property and then sold it to us. And we are now constructing 166 brand new apartments that is going to be absolutely gorgeous.
Now, you've done some work to kind of explain the rationale for affordable housing. Obviously, everybody would like a place to live that which doesn't take their entire paycheck, but there are some other good reasons for making sure that there is a good supply of affordable housing in a community, and one of those reasons is it affects the health of people, right? What have you found on that aspect?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, Ability Housing was one of the leads on a state pilot to do a Florida-specific assessment. And what we found is, not surprisingly, if people don't have an affordable, safe place to live, their health is impacted. We're learning more and more in the community that housing is one of the main social determinants of health. And so if people don't have a stable, safe place they can afford to live, they're exposed to mold, rodents, all sorts of poor environments, plus the children frequently have to change schools, et cetera. So it impacts our health. If we can get people who are homeless off the streets and into housing, our state pilot showed that hospital costs will go down 58%, jail and arrest will go down in the 70s and 80%, and then the educational impacts, our children will be able to have a stable education and do better on their reading, math, and spelling.
All of that, Shannon, sounds, I mean, those are all great reasons to make sure there is affordable housing, but clearly there is a big need. I mean, I know that for the developments that you've been involved with, and also the ones that Sarah was talking about just now, Pindana, the complex, she said there was a pretty big waiting list for folks trying to get in on the ground floor there, so to speak. So given there are all these great reasons to sponsor affordable housing, make sure there's a good supply, who are you trying to get that message through to? Like, who do you need to convince to make sure that we do have the supply to meet that demand?
The biggest one right now, because we're in session, is the Florida legislature. Florida's very unique. We have a trust fund that was set up many years ago to fund affordable housing, and when it was set up, it was actually a national best practice. Unfortunately, for over a decade now, the legislature has used it more as a balance the budget fund mm-hmm. than a resource to build affordable housing. The governor did put in his budget to fully fund these trust funds so that it would be used solely for affordable housing. We're getting conflicting words as to whether the Senate is going to support that or not. Some senators are saying there is no desire to sweep the trust funds. Others are saying with the damage from Michael, there's a lot of need and they may have to use the resources to serve the panhandle and address the storm damage. And then the House, all indications are, is not as on board on the need to not sweep any of the trust funds.
So,
our primary target is legislators.
Right. So just so I'm clear, I mean, if you're talking affordable housing, could you justify spending some of that money on rebuilding the panhandle by saying, well, we're spending on housing? Or is it specifically for affordable housing to meet the ongoing need, quite aside from whatever hurricane or other natural disaster might afflict the state of Florida?
Well, unfortunately, we've gotten in the habit when there's something that comes up, whether it's a natural disaster or the unfortunate school shooting last year, which is why the trust funds were swept last year, we go to these affordable housing trust funds as a source to fund unexpected events. We really can't continue to operate that way. As a state, we have to realize there will be unexpected things that come up. We can't balance the budget on the backs of our working families who do not have an affordable place to live. We must invest in this housing. And the reason we must is because our three biggest budget crunches are health care, criminal justice, and education. Each one is negatively impacted because we're not investing upstream in the housing that the people need so that they're not engaging in criminal justice, have better education attainment, and health care costs go down.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to a panel of experts about the need for affordable housing in Central Florida. You can reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando with your questions and comments. We're also taking calls. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. I'd love to hear your stories about how you might have been impacted, or maybe you're doing something to try and alleviate the affordable housing crunch here in Central Florida. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. Brandon writes into us on Twitter, "My entire paycheck goes to our rent and utilities. My wife's paycheck goes to all other needs and wants. We'd love to buy a house because mortgage is usually cheaper than rent, but neither of us have any credit anywhere we can look for help." Sarah, thoughts on that? I mean, what kind of resources are available to folks who are like, I don't know what to do. I've got to find somewhere to live. What am I going to do?
Yeah, unfortunately, Brandon's not in an unusual situation. There's so many Central Floridians who are going through this. They are completely rent burdened. They can't find the resources to buy a home. I would suggest to Brandon to look into down payment assistance through the city of Orlando, through Orange County, whatever municipality he's in, he might qualify for that based on his income. But just to underline, there are so many people who are in this situation who are really trying to become homeowners. Just those opportunities aren't there currently.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out what are the resources we can provide as a community to create more home ownership and make sure rent is more affordable as well.
Mm-hmm. You can reach out to us on Twitter. Our number is 1-866-338-5252. We're on Twitter also at WMFE Orlando. Amanda Gill, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. You're the Government Affairs Director with the Florida Apartment Association. Shannon Nasworth was talking just a moment or two ago about the need to try and convince our lawmakers in Florida that, for one thing, we don't want to sweep that Sadowski Trust Fund for other things and make sure that that is set aside for affordable housing. But I wonder if you could just talk a little bit generally about how affordable housing fits into the big picture of what the Florida Apartment Association does and kind of what your job is as far as talking to lawmakers and making sure that affordable housing is taken care of as well.
Absolutely. So the issue of affordable housing and the importance of the Sadowski Affordable Housing Trust Fund is actually something that we reiterate as a messaging point to our legislators every year when we go to Tallahassee. We were just there just last month, and that was something that we, really hammered home to them, that it is a big priority for us to not sweep the trust fund. We're obviously very pleased to see that the governor is taking a strong stance on this, and we're hoping that the legislature will follow suit. In addition to Sadowski, we also talked to our legislators about the importance of reducing some of those barriers to development that will help address the supply problem that I think has been a reoccurring theme in the conversation this morning as well.
And what are some of those issues you're talking about? I mean, are you talking about maybe the kind of green belt that people want to preserve around cities to sort of stop development in certain areas, or is it density of housing? What are some of the things that you think would make it easier to put housing in where it's needed and alleviate some of the demand?
Sure. So one of the biggest issues that we see is actually the not in my backyard mentality, where we will actually have local governments or leaders at the local level say, we do not want any more, multifamily development in our community. We want to focus on whether it's retail or other, single family housing options. And so our message point has really been the importance of housing choice and having lots of options for folks to choose from, and also making it easier for folks to construct apartment homes in the areas where affordable housing is most needed.
What about multifamily homes? Has there been a bit of a trend from the kind of development and construction point of view to not just look at homes for single families, but also look at, multiple generations wanting to move in and obviously not wanting to be crammed into a small house, so to speak?
Absolutely. So we're seeing right now a national trend, both in the state of Florida and then nationwide, that folks are actually preferring to rent an apartment home. They like the amenities that apartment homes offer. They love the flexibility of being able to move for a job opportunity and things of that nature. And you're seeing this is happening across all generations, and folks are actually preferring to live in an apartment home and have that sense of community that is different than what you would experience in a single family home. And you're seeing lots of different products out there, both studio style apartment homes and also multi-bedroom units where you see families living in them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, what about that notion of multifamily homes and also the idea that Amanda was touching on of the not in my backyard mentality? I mean, people like to have you know, they'd like to have a neighborhood that's sort of well-maintained. They'd like to know that when they move in somewhere, there's not going to be a high-rise going up next door. How do you kind of balance some of those competing demands?
There's definitely been a rise in multifamily construction. That's probably one of the fastest growing areas of housing.
Mm-hmm.
But there is still a missing middle of housing that doesn't speak to that, right? So there's lots of multifamily housing that's being built. There's still construction that's happening with single family detached housing. But there is this missing middle of townhomes, triplexes, other places where you can think about either home ownership or rental that doesn't look like a high rise apartment in an urban area.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is, when we talk about housing choices, that's one of them that is currently lacking a supply of, and would also help in terms of increasing housing supply. Regarding NIMBYism, not in my backyard, that's a tough one, right? And so for Westlakes, we've been able to, I wouldn't say overcome it, but help bring folks to the conversation to say, this is what's happening in the neighborhood. Prior to Lyft Orlando or Westlake's partnership being organized,
mm-hmm.
Their apartments on Orange Center Boulevard were really a high crime spot. They were definitely homes for folks and a place to live and shelter and all of those really great things. But for the rest of the neighborhood, it was also a place where crime happened. And you want your kids to live in a safe neighborhood and be stable and be able to come back to the neighborhood and feel pride in it. And I think that's what's happening now when you can bring folks to the table and say, okay, this is the vision that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And this housing is high quality and up to par with anything you'd want to see anywhere, whether it's College Park or Baldwin Park or anywhere else in the city. This is what's happening in Westlakes. So I think overcoming that NIMBYism has to do with doing some real deep community conversations about mm-hmm. why we need this.
And there's a bit of give and take too, right? I mean, you do see that in some of the older neighborhoods, the sort of more wealthy neighborhoods, that there are sometimes patches of land where there will be an apartment block go up, and there's a lot of back and forth about, do we want this here or not?
I think College Park definitely experienced that with the Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's just, it really is a give and take and having conversations. I think the folks in College Park who are listening are probably shaking their heads and still a little bit upset about that. But regarding housing supply, it's definitely a need.
Mm-hmm.
I think folks at politicians, community leaders, residents need to be prepared to have those conversations, but really also need to have an understanding of what our region needs to grow.
Mm-hmm. Shannon Nasworth, when you go into a community, you partner up with a city or a county or what have you, and you start to work on one of these developments, are you noticing anything different about the kinds of folks who are lining up to move in? Like, has there been a change in the demographics of people saying, yes, I really need some help sort of getting into an apartment? Has that been pretty stable and pretty much the same since you started working on these projects, or are you seeing kind of more folks from different sectors of society saying, yeah, that, you know, the rent's too high and we do need some help sort of, and we could use some affordable housing ourselves?
Yes, we are seeing, as housing prices continue to go up and wages just aren't keeping up, more and more professions are having wages where people can't afford the housing. And especially since the downturn, when so many people were impacted and there were foreclosures, et cetera, a lot of people who, you know, 10, 15 years ago would not have normally been renters are much more pre-inclined to be a renter now. So it is a much more diverse group of individuals. It's our teachers. It's the guy who works at the dry cleaners. It's the maid at the hotel. You know, it's all of our neighbors who we need to have in our community working alongside us, making it a diverse and vibrant community and economy. When people hear about affordable housing, they get a preconceived notion in their head. And the reality is, it's just housing. And, you know, we have people come to our apartments not realizing they're affordable and ask if they can rent, and they're earning well above the maximum income that we're allowed to let people rent at. So affordable housing is just housing like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are learning more about that, but it still does have that knee-jerk reaction of concern about impact on safety and property values. And every study shows that those concerns are not based on the facts.
Mm-hmm. Got a tweet here from Celestial Tostflis who writes in, what about creating a rent cap in order to control property management companies from creating inflation? Well, the notion of some kind of rent control is something that has been floated by at least a couple of lawmakers here in Central Florida. Not sure what kind of reception that is going to get in Tallahassee, but Sarah, is that an idea that's been floating around for a while, the idea of rent control?
I think amongst renters, of course, that conversation's been happening. I think the median rental increase year over year has been about 3% recently, but that fluctuates greatly.
And
I think Maitland and Lake Mary are experiencing something like 6 to 7% increase year over year, which is, you know, significant.
And wages probably aren't keeping pace with that.
No, yeah. So I think that's a really strong conversation that's happening at a grassroots level. I think it's important for it to go up to Tallahassee for us to think about what that looks like. I think for developers and landlords, that's also a conversation of, does it make sense for me to keep pushing rent the way that it is?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's high profits there, but at the same time, am I going to instigate a regulation on me at a state level because I keep increasing rents at such a dramatic rate?
Mm-hmm. Well, Amanda Gill, let me put that question to you. How does the Florida Apartment Association feel about the idea of rent control and some kind of statewide rent control? Does that seem like a good idea?
Well, we looked at the evidence on this, and the evidence doesn't just suggest, it actually confirms that the one-size-fits-all approach of rent control has a detrimental impact on the housing market in general. And we've seen that in several other states, and it actually reduces the quantity and the quality of the housing available. It reduces property values in the region, which affects both renters and non-renters. And it also increased costs as far as implementing those programs at the local government level.
Is there something, though, I mean, can local governments help out a little bit? Is there some incentive that they could use to encourage development, even if there is some form of rent control?
So in lieu of rent control, which in our view, based on the evidence, is just not a solution that actually produces results. So what we would say is we would look to local governments to actually work collaboratively with the housing community, with developers, with folks who work on these projects in public-private partnership settings to actually address the affordable housing need, whether that's incentives by reducing impact fees or increasing density bonuses, making it easier to build parking for residents. All of those sorts of tools in the toolbox are much more impactful and useful than rent control, which we know does not produce results.
Right, okay. I got a tweet coming in here from Rachel Christian. Rachel writes, the affordable housing crisis is especially bad in Osceola County. One reason may be increasingly high mobility fees, which makes it cost prohibitive to build apartments and basically kills true affordable housing. Shannon, I wonder if you might chime in on this. I mean, we've reported on stories here at WMFE about the housing crisis in Osceola County and how that affects folks, particularly kind of who are working in the hospitality industry. But what are you seeing there? And is that an area that Ability Housing might be looking to help out the government there, the local governments there, and put in some affordable housing as well?
Actually, yes. We're working with a for-profit developer in Osceola, and we'll be starting construction of a property later this year. So we are working in Osceola. We're also looking to partner with a local nonprofit who's based in Osceola to see if we can help them develop some affordable housing on some property that they own. We do know that the need is desperate, actually, in every community, unfortunately, but especially with so many families living in the motels and those motels being converted and therefore not being housing anymore, even if it is currently poor housing, it really is a crisis that everybody needs to focus on so we can keep those families in safe housing.
Mm-hmm. And when you say converted, what what do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot, as I think everybody is aware, there's a lot of families living on 192 in old motels, and property values are going up, and people are redeveloping the areas and you know, turning them into other types of properties. They're knocking down and rebuilding, and the redevelopment, while not a bad thing for the community necessarily, for the people who have found that to be the only housing they can access, that's a crisis for them.
Well, Shannon Nasworth, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for joining the program. Shannon is the President and CEO of Ability Housing. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We're also joined by Amanda Gill. She is the Government Affairs Director with the Florida Apartment Association. Amanda, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Sarah Albadri is a Special Projects Manager with Westlakes Partnership. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, we'll take a look back at the last few days, the first few days of session, rather. Intersection continues in a minute.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The legislative session is underway after a State of the State address from Governor Ron DeSantis that mixed environmental policy and had bipartisan appeal with a more conservative stance on issues like immigration. So what does the State of the State augur for the legislative session? For more, we're joined by Tramell Gomes from Tallahassee. Well, Tramell Gomes is the host of the Rotunda podcast. Welcome back to Intersection, Tramell.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
A busy start to this year from this new governor, Ron DeSantis, and an action-packed couple first months, and then quite a lot to unpack from his State of the State speech. What was going through your mind as you listened to that speech and observed the reactions from some of the lawmakers up there in Tallahassee?
Well, it was a very popular speech. It was received with applause from everyone in the packed chamber. As you know, the opening days, it's very ceremonial, and everything is great, everyone's agreeing, and everyone is getting along. That's what opening days are usually about. But in the details of his speech, you can see where the tone that he was striking for the first couple of months, that was very moderate to the surprise of many, expecting a hardline conservative, it started to show where he started to play more into his conservative base with some of the policies that he highlighted there, particularly with immigration.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because as you point out, immigration was one of the things where he hewed more closely to the conservative line of thinking there, especially on undocumented immigration. What did you hear in that, and how do you see it playing out policy-wise?
What I heard was he played to the strong base, and when you talk to Democrats, it's a sign that he is essentially appealing to President Donald Trump, and it's a play for 2020 and embracing Florida, cushioning Florida to have that support there when you're talking about sanctuary cities and making Florida not a place for sanctuary cities, which the stats show like one in five immigrants live in Florida. So it's kind of playing to that field that will get those strong hardline conservatives out to the polls. So people are thinking he is just planning ahead and talking directly to President Trump when he is on that particular issue.
Were you surprised a little bit, though, Tramell Gomes, to hear that? Because in his first couple months in office, we haven't really heard so much along the lines of what we did hear during the campaign when he really sort of embraced that message from President Donald Trump and really was courting that particular set of voters. Since he's taken office, we haven't heard so much of that. So it was interesting to me to hear that come out again. Was it a little bit surprising to you, or was it something that you were expecting?
It was something that me personally, I was expecting, because from the very strong message that he ran with during the campaign that appealed to the base that got him elected. When he made it into office in the first few months, everyone was surprised to not see that same person. It's like, where did Congressman DeSantis, the candidate, go? When he became governor, it was he made this very moderate tone. He won over a lot of Democrats with his environmental agenda, and it was just shocking. So it was just only a matter of time to see the policies that brought him into the governor's mansion, to see them roll out and for him to put at ease his conservatives and his Republican allies who were probably wondering, hey, what's going on? Why are you doing all of these things? We didn't put you in office for that. So, yeah, that's how it's all playing out so far.
He spent a lot of time talking about education, and we have heard quite a lot already. We have a pretty good idea of where he stands on education, whether it's K through 12, higher education. What did you hear in the State of the State, Tramell Gomes, and where do you see this, or how do you see this playing out in the year ahead?
On the issue of education, this is another issue where Democrats are now reeling back and saying, like, hey, we're not really supportive of this policy, which is more leaning towards the expansion of school voucher in Florida. It would make tuition funds available to an additional, 14,000 students. And it's an issue that Democrats are like, the expansion of charter schools, taking tax dollars to support those private entities that are getting public dollars. So that's another pushback you're seeing with the Florida Education Association. They're pushing back on that, saying it's not good, it's not fair for the taxpayers of the state of Florida to pay their taxes to support families that want to take their kids to private school. And so on that, you have some tension there. And so education was one of the highlights that he took charge in, and the one who is helping him with his education initiatives is former House Speaker Richard Corcoran. Going into the election for governor, we were expecting Richard Corcoran to run for governor, but he ended up taking the backseat and not throwing his hat in the race, and now he's the education secretary for Florida. So some of those policies that Corcoran heavily lobbied for and supported, particularly dealing with charter schools and school choice, is what we're going to be seeing playing out and pushing forward ahead during this legislative session.
On to the Democratic response then. What did you hear in that? I mean, the tone from Ron DeSantis and the response from lawmakers was pretty positive, but then you have the other side of the coin, the other side of the picture there from the Democrats. What stood out for you from the response that we heard on Tuesday?
What stood out was the Democrats really saying or realizing that, like, hey, the honeymoon is over. They challenged him on his be bold message, and Audrey Gibson, Senator Audrey Gibson, who gave the Democratic response, really took a point in saying these bold steps aren't really new. She criticized his stance on education and sanctuary cities out of concern for the potential harm for immigrants. So they pretty much came and actually proposed their own agenda, calling for raising the minimum wage to expand Medicaid and implementing universal background checks for guns. And so they took a stance of listening to the governor's message and put forward their own proposal, and they're calling it the Sunrise Agenda, with those issues that they care about. So it's pretty much, you can say, the honeymoon is over from the DeSantis new administration coming in, and with the start of session, it's sort of like play ball, and now they're going to all get down to the issues, and you're going to see where the lines are with regards to more of the partisan issues that will be taken up.
Right, but having said that, I mean, the Democrats are not playing from a position of strength given their numbers in Tallahassee. How much of that agenda do you see realistically getting passed, or how much influence are they going to have in this session?
That is a very good point. They're not coming from a position of strength. And what they are doing, though, is actually showing that they will not just lie down and not let anything happen. They're using anything within their power at this point, because they do not have the leadership in the chambers to make a lot of sway. But in the trading of issues, maybe some more conservative issues or moderate issues that Democrats might lean for, there are going to be times where there's going to be need for some bipartisan work along those issues. So they will hold on to some of those carrots that they have to make their influence. And by them putting out something like this, like a Sunrise Agenda, they are playing to their base. They are bringing up the issues that matter to them and their constituents. And maybe they're showing that, like, you know, hey, they're trying to work. And depending on how things go the next election cycle, it's a platform that they will continue to push and try to see implemented along the way. So you're right, they don't have a position of power, but what they're showing is that they're not going to sit back and not do anything at all. They're going to continue to fight along the way.
There are a few things that we're looking at here to see how they play out as far as constitutional amendments go. One of them being the amendment that would restore voting rights to felons who've served their sentence in Florida. What do you see happening with that, Tramell Gomes?
We're all waiting to see how that goes. I haven't seen the latest movement on that, but as far as criminal justice reform, that issue was passed. It received overwhelming support from voters, and a lot of people are waiting, former felons who are waiting to get their rights restored. And some legislation moving through the legislature would somewhat deal with finding some solution to a broader scale of addressing criminal justice reform. On the issue of Amendment 4, it's to be seen. It's an issue that they will have to address pretty soon because it was passed and some lawmakers were jockeying to have the legislature, including Governor DeSantis, calling for the legislature to take a one take and address it once over before actually implementing it into law. So that's going to be all played out, and I'm going to be checking to see how it all ends up.
And another issue that's been of concern for a couple of years now is how medical marijuana reform rolls out from here. And of course, we've had some pretty outspoken advocates for smokable medical marijuana, in particular in Central Florida, with trial lawyer John Morgan outspoken on the issue and appearing at a press conference not too long ago alongside Governor DeSantis. So what do you see happening there?
That's another example of the broad appeal Governor DeSantis has been able to strike with those who didn't expect him to be an advocate on this issue or a supporter of this issue. He's been able to win over someone like John Morgan, who probably was surprised to have this ally to see and push this initiative forward. And where we are now is hearing from some of the lawmakers, Senator Jeff Brandis and Representative Ray Rodriguez. They confirmed that they've reached some sort of an agreement on a proposal that would allow patients to purchase up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana for smoking every 35 days, banning smoking of medical marijuana in public places, and allow temporarily ill children to smoke the treatment, but only if they have a second opinion from a pediatrician. I think there's been some back and forth regarding that requirement to have like a second doctor, and some are seeing that that's an unnecessary extra hurdle. If you're approved by one, why do you need to go to a second doctor for approval? But overall, we're going to be seeing some quick movement on that issue with medical marijuana in the coming weeks, because just seeing here that these lawmakers have reached agreement. So that's going to probably hit the floor pretty soon and bring some resolution and have someone like John Morgan very happy.
Tramell Gomes at the Capitol in Tallahassee. He's the host of the Rotunda podcast. Tramell, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And all week, the 90.7 News team has been reporting on some of the big issues facing lawmakers in our Legislative Preview 2019 series. If you have questions about medical marijuana, environmental policy, the commercial space industry, LGBTQ protections, or arts funding, the News team is on Twitter this afternoon from 12 to 1 taking your questions. You can send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando with the hashtag AskWMFE. Up next, music from CC Tenniel and The Soul Commotion. We're back in a minute. Not to lose my smile and appreciate my blessings, to a place where I can just be myself, to a place where I ain't no different than anyone else. I wanna go home. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit an interview with CC Tenniel and The Soul Commotion. They were one of the local favourites from WMFE's Tiny Desk contest last year. Here's the title track from their album, 5 or 5,000. I've been searching for the best of me, kind of feeling like I ain't got a chance. Always seems like I hit a wall. In spite of all I do, I wanna give up. But when I see those smiling faces looking back at me, whether it's 5 or 5,000, I don't wanna let them down. I don't wanna let them down. And you're listening to 5 or 5,000 from CC Tenniel and The Soul Commotion. CC Tenniel and Chris Baptiste are with us from the band. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
CC, I've read that you've been described as the voice of neo-blues. What exactly is neo-blues?
I think when we started the initial term of neo-blues, and Chris can chime in whenever he's ready, but we thought about adding some new elements to the blues. So we wanted to focus on merging genres because people love music in general. So if we could take blues as the undercurrent and add soul to that, add jazz to that, add rock, a lot of rock, to that, you know, and make it more more of an alternative genre versus just straight ahead blues, which is what we were going to. So the term neo typically signifies new. So we were saying new blues.
So when you all formed, you wanted just to be a straight ahead blues band?
No, we never were a straight-ahead blues band at all, but we did a lot of time at B.B. King's Blues Club, and so that's where I think a lot of us fell in love with that blues sound because it was so organic and so transparent, if you will. But then we also liked so many other genres of music that we just didn't want to be pigeonholed into being a blues band.
Mm-hmm. Chris, how long has the band been together?
Oh, man, this band has been together, I would say. Let me see. I'm 35. I was about 21. We started in some form around 2003, 2004, mm-hmm. Just playing downtown Orlando, and that's way before B.B. King's Blues Club was open. So, me and CeCe and Terrell, and I and LaVon a lot even also.
Mm-hmm. He's your guitarist?
Yes, LaVon on guitar. We would all play downtown every Sunday night. We call the show Sunday Night Live at the AKA Lounge on Pine Street. And that's about how long? About 2003, 2004. Yeah, I grew up in this band.
Wow.
Yeah.
Has the sound changed a lot?
The sound has changed so much. Y'all speaking about neo blues. And like I said, it was before B.B. King's was open. So we would play mostly R&B and neo soul style of music. And then CeCe was working at B.B. King's with LaVon, mm-hmm. and the rest of us were not for maybe about the first year and a half to 2 years of them opening. Then I came on and joined at B.B. King's after playing a lot of pop music in Top 40. And so with the big neo-soul background, the, of course, soul, we all have parents listen to a lot of soul and mm-hmm. Earth, Wind, and Fire and funk and things like that. A huge gospel background, because through all this time, we were all still playing in church every Sunday.
That's the sort of backbone of your music?
In a major way. So just how the sound has developed over all those years with the time spent and experiences and different genres, where we are now, we're like, well, is it blues? Is it soul? Is it rock? We're like, listen, we just want to be ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if we're creating, and whatever's in us is going to come out, and it's a little bit of everything.
What about the audiences then? Are you getting some good audiences for your shows these days?
They're all over the place, really. I mean, our audiences, they range from, you know, from 6 to 65 is what we say sometimes, which is kind of how we got to the 5 or 5,000 thing, because, you know, you never know what age, what nationality, what, you know, social status anybody has that's in the audience. And so we, no matter who it is, we want to give a premium show every time.
How do your songs get written?
Well, let's take it back to B.B. King's Blues Club once again. There was two singers, if anybody had been there during our time there with the All-Star Band. CeCe was the lead female vocalist, and the lead male vocalist is my guy Rod Wilson. Shout out to Rod Wilson. Rod Wilson was an amazing singer and performer, but prior to B.B. King's, he had done many world tours, singing with like Gloria Estefan, and done records, has gold records from singing and writing and producing. So he like fell in love with CeCe. I've known him just from my piano teacher. Mm-hmm. It was like one of his best friends. So when we met at B.B. King's, he was like, Chris, you're all grown up now. So we had a relationship. He met CeCe, fell in love with CeCe. They became great friends. And as a producer already in his own right, amazing songwriter, he writes basically all our songs, the majority of everything.
Yes, he does.
You can see the credits on the album. And, you know, he even performs with us sometimes. Rod's a senior member, if I may. He's not really into trying to be on stage like we are, but he'll perform with us from time to time, but he's our writer. CeCe's done a lot more writing now than before. She does have an album before where Rod, I believe, did all of the writing, mm-hmm. but now on 5 or 5,000, CeCe has a bunch more writer's credit. So as far as how our songs get written, lyrically, comes from Rod, and then secondly, CeCe.
You know. It's really interesting because our writing formula, if you will, mm-hmm. is kind of, I'll say, Rod, I think I was feeling like this today. And so I'll give him a concept. And then like 48 hours later, he'll say, Chris, I need you to come lay down these pianos that I'm hearing for this song CeCe, you know, has this concept for. So it's really a very organic evolution for each song. You know, it could be something I'm riding down the street and I see a sign and I'm like, you know what? You know, so that's kind
of
how.
That's pretty amazing. You can just give them that little germ of an idea and
literally,
a song will be born out of it 48 hours later.
Like, we have this one song called 5 or 5,000, right? That's the title of the album. And basically, in my bio for the longest, we had said, you know, 5 or 5,000, regardless of how many people are there, we're going to give the same show. And so Chris and I were going back and forth about what the title of the album should be and, you know, how we're going to do this song. And that's actually the song we did for the Tiny Desk Contest, is 5 or 5,000. And we basically said that to Rod, and he just came back with a song.
Came out with a song.
So tell me about the experience of recording that video for the Tiny Desk. This is the first time you've entered in the contest?
Yes, this is the first time. I heard about the contest last year when with Tank and the Bangers. And they were just so amazing. And I, you know, it's awesome when a band, you look at them and you say, huh, I think we should do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we, so we started talking about it then. And the recording the video was interesting because we did, I don't know, we did two different videos. And the first one we had, we said, not quite the right energy yet. And so then we went and recorded another one.
Oh, you're telling the secret.
So this is the second take.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But you know, for us, it was that important. It was that important that we put our best foot forward to the world the first time, you know. So regardless of how many times we saw it, you know, before, we wanted to make sure that we presented the right product. And I love the, you know, my band, because they said, although this is good, it's not what we want to present first. So we're very, I won't say critical, but we're very honest with each other about, you know, how we want to appear, what our image is.
What about shooting a music video, though? Is that something which was new for you guys?
I'd done it one time before. I covered Eleanor Rigby, which is a Beatles song,
yeah,
and did a blues version of that. So we did a video of it.
I want to see that now.
Yeah, that was my first time doing
just YouTube CCTV. Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah, and it was one of the reviews that we got on that song was that it was, you know, normally people shouldn't try to touch the Beatles, but this was a super good rendition of it. And we just, you know, slowed it down. But that was my first experience with music videos. Mm-hmm. But it was all me. So this one was really cool because I got to actually be performing, and it was with, you know, with the band. So I don't know. I love being on stage with them. So.
Well, CeCe Tennille and The Soul Commotion, their new album is 5 or 5,000. CeCe Tennille and Chris Baptiste, keyboard player from the band, thank you so much for coming in and speaking about your music and sharing a little bit about your album.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
And that interview first aired last June. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for this week's show from Emily Lang. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. The legislative session is underway, and this week the 90.7 News team has been reporting on some of the big issues facing lawmakers. This afternoon from 12 to 1, our reporters will be on Twitter responding to your questions about space policy, the environment, LGBTQ issues, medical marijuana, and arts funding. You can tweet your questions to @WMFEOrlando with the hashtag AskWMFE. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. I wanna go home.